Dr. Future back with Tom and with Dr. Jerome Corsi. Dr. Corsi, you there with us?
Yep, I'm right here.
I hope you enjoyed that.
That was great.
Yeah, that brings back some memories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes that pat on the back might just hold you back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's jump into something completely different here I want to ask you about. And I don't know how you're going to answer this.
Okay.
And I don't know where we're all going to fall on this, okay?
Hmm.
But I just want to say, no matter where we all have in our opinions, I respect your opinion on these issues. It's a very simple question and something that I've wondered. And it's regarding this whole Islamic threat issue that we have with the potential of, Islamic fundamentalism and what's going on in the Middle East spreading over here to the U.S., like we saw exhibited at 9/11. The question that I've had to confront myself with recently, since I've been really rethinking and re-asking a lot of questions about a lot of fundamental positions I've had, is that if there is still a legitimate risk that we have of Islamic fundamentalists coming over and creating major terrorist events in our country, poisoning our water, bombing major public centers, or doing whatever they plan to do, how can we justify our government not defending our lengthy borders, which is the easiest way to facilitate their entry, as opposed to sending our defenders thousands of miles away to other countries, rather than stopping them where they can come right in and send their coercive agents right across our border, and to fight so hard to try to prevent anyone from trying to defend it? You know, there's a few answers that I can think of with it, and none of them really please me too much. I want to ask you what you think about it, or something completely different. You know, one answer could be is that our defense experts and leaders are so incompetent that they can't perceive that simple incongruity, or B, they're all in cahoots with terrorists and want to look the other way, or C, that this whole threat of widespread terrorism in the U.S. soil is a myth and is being used as a deception to cover the elite's real objectives in the Middle East, as some think, and to provide some kind of context for them to repeal our civil rights and constitutional freedoms with the Patriot Act and similar orders, just like the Reichstag fire, or D, some other reason that I've not listed. What's with my thinking here? You certainly study these things a lot more than myself.
Well, first of all, I think it's ridiculous to have wide open borders if we've got a war on terror.
Mm.
It doesn't make any sense. And we have prosecuted terrorists who've come across the border. We've had just this case of Muhammad Kurani, who was I read about that in the late, great USA. He bribed Mexican officials in Beirut. They came across the border with Mexico and set up shop in Dearborn, Michigan, where he was sending money back to Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that case shows that Hezbollah terrorists have gotten in here. And if one got in here, there's got to be more.
Right. And our biggest concern would be people are actually planning attacks on our own soil. It's
right.
One thing for them to be sending conduits of money back, but it's one thing the immediate danger they pose to us here.
Well, if it's all... So the first thing I start with is something's got to be wrong with this picture.
Right.
In other words, if the borders are wide open, it makes no sense at all to say that we've got a war on terror. None at all. So either the war on terror is a lie,
right,
or the open borders are the reality, and that's what we're really pushing for here is a integration with Mexico and Canada, which is what I'm arguing, and maybe some of both.
Right. Now, I understand that. I understand they may have a motive to not worry about that border because we're already planning to merge us together. They want to keep everybody on the same side, not get the Mexican government upset, all the above. But then they're not defending the Mexican-Guatemalan border or sea entry from the Gulf or in any other ways apart from the Mexican border.
Well, Mexico's not defending its own borders very well at all, Guatemala. And, look, the whole idea of border defense in North America is just not happening. It's probably not happening much anywhere in the world except, Mexico does a better job of protecting its border with us than we ever do of defending our border with them. The underlying I've argued that the Security and Prosperity Partnership was an agreement that we would increasingly open the borders. And I think that that's the reality. That's where the reality is. That we're behind the scenes, wink, wink, saying we're going to let more Mexicans into the United States because we want the cheap labor to exploit it. Jobs we can't send to China, we'll exploit an underclass here to do cheaply. That seems to be the agenda. And, you know, the Islamic terrorists, we're also letting criminal gangs into the United States. We're
right.
Murderers, we're letting drug dealers. All the borders are just wide open. And across the borders, openly, criminality sees an opportunity and comes. That's, you know, you'd be insane not to expect that to be the case. And then, but then we do things like, you know, Bush puts in a Merida initiative, and we commit $1.4 billion to Mexican drug, you know, the Mexican army to fight the drug war. Well, that makes no sense at all when the border is wide open.
Right.
And when the Mexican army largely works with the Mexican drug cartels, not with the Mexican government to stop the cartels. We train paramilitary before in Mexico, the Zetas, and they fight with the drug cartels. So the money we're sending down there, all the money we send down to Mexico gets lost.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gets taken by the government and stolen, or the, you know, the few families who run the oligarchy that is Mexico siphon off all the money that comes in there to their benefit.
Much like the money that we sent our own government for a war or building a fence.
Yeah, I mean, none of it, we're not going to have a fence. We passed a law to build a fence, the Secure Fence Act of 2006, and then we didn't build any fence. It was a public relations effort. Mm-hmm. President Bush signs it. They have a big, you know, speech and ceremony. We're now going to be securing our borders. It's just before the November elections. Nothing happens. Then Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson introduces an amendment to the Department of Homeland Security funding that takes the fence out of the Secure Fence Act. It says that it's up to the Department of Homeland Security to hold hearings along the border, determine if a fence is necessary. Well, the Department of Homeland Security goes down there to the border and tells people they're going to take their land and build a fence
mm-hmm.
and not pay them. So, of course, people don't want a fence. Say, you know, you're not going to deny my access to the Rio Grande and cut me off, build a fence on my property and not pay me. I own the property. And then Chertoff says, see, they don't want a fence. So we can't build a fence because they don't want it. Well, if we went down there and gave those people millions of dollars, they'd want the fence. They might want two.
You know, they don't have problems with eminent domain and taking anybody else's property.
Especially when it comes
here,
to the...
When you have an entire country at stake on what happens.
Well, they don't want to build a fence because they want the labor, the cheap labor, to be able to swim across the Rio Grande and get in here so that they can exploit the labor.
You know, I understand.
The multinational, it's the corporate, this whole idea of globalism is a corporate agenda because they're the only ones who benefit.
I understand all of that. And I don't dispute any of that. Makes natural sense. What I don't understand is how they can tell us to keep looking for people with suspicious activities at power plants or water plants, or we're doing everything we can, we're spending all this money to protect our ports or do whatever, when they don't see it's an urgent kind of thing to watch people walking across our border that could be trying to do things more than just take a job, you know, trying to actually create terrorism.
Like I say, you know, it makes you suspect that the war on terror itself is another charade.
That's what I'm asking myself, Dr. Corsi. I mean, it's the unthinkable, but I keep wondering if what these people propose, this audacious idea, is it possible?
It's possible. I mean, all that we've done so far is pass more laws like the Patriot Act, which restrict freedoms.
Right.
As long as you contain the idea that we're under this great threat, from whatever, the Islamic terrorists, whatever the threat currently is, communists, whatever it was at one particular time or is now, it's a way for the government to scare people and get them to give up freedoms.
And condition people. When you look at Guantanamo Bay and people kept without charges brought before them, you know, I'll admit, you know, to all my listeners here, I have come from a very conservative paradigm. I've become from your classic right kind of paradigm, you know, social, moral, economic, all of it. And so a lot of this is really sort of shaking me to the core and wondering what do I know that I really believe, because, you know, I was a patriotic person. I thought, you know, we got to defend ourselves. All these people were killed. But then I start reading history books and realizing these same kind of things were done by other administrations in Germany and elsewhere to condition people to accept the gradual removal of our rights.
Well, see, it's part of, you know, when you take a look at all these, it's like, okay, so you've gotten this Jeremiah Wright, who is, railing against the United States, hating the United States. when you look at liberation theology and get into this, okay, so there's, he's talking about the Tuskegee experiment. We know what the Tuskegee experiment was. They injected African Americans with syphilis and other diseases of that nature, see what would happen. And they conducted experiments on African Americans in the 20s and 30s where they would induce diseases in the population. They used the African Americans as if they were guinea pigs without telling them that's what they were doing. So when, you know, when Jeremiah Wright says that AIDS was created as a virus to destroy African Americans, and he refers to the Tuskegee experiments, you know, for the vast majority of whites who hear that, they say this guy's crazy because he's, you know, making this wild assertion. But in his mind, in his frame of reference, and from what he knows, it's happened before. And the Tuskegee experiments are now fully documented and fully exposed. But that took investigative work to do and was denied by the government for years.
And the most dangerous people to these elites are historians. Because all we have to do is look at correct and accurate history books to recognize this modus operandi.
Well, and, okay, so Jeremiah Wright, I mean, I'm not trying to justify everything Jeremiah Wright says because I think he's over the top, but he comes and says, you know, World War II was known to be, we knew it was going to happen and we did not do anything to stop it because President Roosevelt wanted to get us into the war, and so we didn't tell anybody that it was coming. Well, you know, I've got a book on my bookshelf here called Day of Deceit, written by Robert Stinnett, which was a book published on that same theory with some pretty good research done. Now, I'm not sure I'm convinced by it, but we've held at least two or three major congressional hearings on the same idea because we were breaking the Japanese code. There was information about the... We should have been able to identify from the Japanese code we'd broken what their movement of their ships was, and it was clear that President Roosevelt was baiting the Japanese into attacking us. I mean, he'd taken away their oil. He'd done everything he could to insult them and to put them into a position where they were going to feel cornered and threatened. And so, you know, President Roosevelt wanted into World War II, but he knew the United States people weren't going to go into World War II unless we'd been attacked. So it's not a preposterous theory. I mean, it may not be provable, and it may not even be true. Roosevelt may have been shocked that Pearl Harbor was attacked, but, you know, there was good intelligence that we knew that Japan was preparing to attack us somewhere.
But, you know, you have enough information already in your areas you're studying now that I would assume you hardly take anything that our government says in a press conference or politicians with a grain of salt.
I take none of it.
It's just all flapping gums, and it really has absolutely no bearing one way or the other to the truth or not either way.
I start off by saying, why are they doing this?
Right. What's the motive? What are they trying to manipulate us?
And I want who's going to win by this happen? Who makes money? Who wins when this happens? I start there with everything government does, rather than their explanations of what they do are, you know, you can listen to them and they're interesting, but they're mostly diversions.
Right.
You know, you very rarely get a president who comes on and says, you know, I think that we need to go into the Vietnam War because they were going to make all these billions of dollars with the war equipment.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at the Pentagon, look at the Pentagon contracts and the contractors and the money being made, you know, it's a pretty reasonable argument that a lot of people benefited from that war.
Right, yeah.
Same from World War II. I mean, World War II was basically what it took to get us out of the Depression. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have fought World War II.
Right.
And I'm not saying that, you know, Hitler and fascism and Japan and its imperialism shouldn't have been resisted. But I am saying that the imperialists, you know, we being called imperialists and capitalists and accused of having profited from the war is not an accusation you can just dismiss out of hand.
That's right. That's right. There's a lot more than meets the eye in what's going on. This relates to something more current. This is not something I was going to ask you immediately, but it really relates to what we're doing as far as just busting our paradigms right now, which is something that I think needs to happen to me and to other people. And what I find ironic is, you know, we're talking about these statements by political officials, whether it's Obama today or the government. You watch the 24-hour news shows on TV, they treat all of it like it's very, very serious business, and you will have pundits on both sides take it just straight up as face value and go from there, which now that when the blinders are off of me, I just stand agog at how these people can take these things seriously anymore. You know, and then you've got, quote, nuts, like those of us on low-power FM or internet radio or things like that, who are trying to put a historical context of all of this, you know, and we're made out to be on the fringe in this kind of thing, and hopefully we're growing in numbers. But that related to something that just happened recently, that's sort of the same line of thought. A few weeks ago, I guess it's probably actually been maybe a month or two, we had this big event over in the Persian Gulf where supposedly these Iranian gunboats came over by our ships.
Right.
And all of a sudden you hear, you know, they're like little speedboats, and then you hear this bizarre voice. And when I first heard it, I guess just from, you know, having gone over things that you have done and others, I had an immediate skepticism because it sounded very artificial to me.
Right.
But this voice comes in and says, "We are coming after you. We're going to blow you up in 2 minutes."
Right.
Some other things like that that were somewhat laughable. You would expect to hear a 7-year-old doing that on somebody's telephone. Anyway, that was taken immediately, extremely serious by the government, is an immediate threat. Immediately after that, there was a Republican debate. And every one of our Republican candidates, save one, said, well, we just need to go over there immediately and go deal with them. We need to go take them on, and this is war talk right here. In fact, I can remember the Minister Huckabee saying something to the effect that I personally look forward to sending them to hell. Which sort of took me aback a little bit.
Really?
Yeah, I remember. I'm paraphrasing, but that's, that was just, the only person who dissented was Ron Paul, who said, you know, we might want to just verify to see where this voice came from before we go to war immediately and cost millions of lives. And then right at that same day all of this came out, there was a report released by the NSA. They declassified about the Gulf of Tonkin, where they admitted that it was a complete fabrication. The whole thing, and what the irony of it, when I, you know, I'm at an age where I was extremely young, just at the time of being born and all that came out, started doing a little reading on the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and how that event triggered Congress to give Johnson far-reaching powers to basically begin to wage war without a declaration of war by Congress.
Correct.
And I started to see such an amazing foreshadowing, you know, it was almost like deja vu. That here we're having some other kind of event happening. And then one night in the wee hours of the night, I hear a little press announcement late at night from the government saying, oh, well, we're not so sure that voice came from those ships. And then a few days after that, Drudge or somebody comes out and says that it was very likely came from this hacker or heckler called the Filipino Monkey. He was actually was used to heckling for decades, these guys, when they're going up and down in the Gulf. I'm paraphrasing some of the details here, but the thing that I see here is that if anything looked like the guise of a false flag operation, this sure looked like something to me, or at least using it as an excuse. How do you put all this in context for us to understand what's really going on?
The Tonkin Gulf incident was a hoax. It has been fully vetted and explained, and you know the Congress has looked into it. Now there's enough on the public record to understand that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was used as a power grab by Johnson to get a resolution, as you pointed out, that he could use to justify expanding the war in Vietnam. As soon as I saw the incident with the Iranian boats, I immediately thought of the Gulf of Tonkin.
You know, they made the announcement the same day, if I remember correctly.
The Gulf of Tonkin information's been out for quite a while.
Oh, I understand. I had some people tell me, hey, we know about this for a while, that was bogus. But there were certain documents released.
Could be. But
that said that it wasn't even something that was a minor skirmish, that it was a total fabrication.
But it's been out for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that information's been available for probably 10 years or more.
Really?
I've known of that for at least 10 years.
Well, yeah, I heard some people that say they had some suspicion, but they released documents on that day
were
declassified that said that nothing happened, and that they actually had the tape recordings from Air Force pilots that flew over the supposed attack scene that were released that day, saying we don't see anything going on down here. How do we know to trust our government in anything they say like this, that it's legitimate with this kind of pattern?
We saw an incident. Of course, you know the Iranians are nuts, and they did have that incident where they captured the British troops, you know,
right,
maybe,
right.
And they'd run these speedboats around,
mm-hmm.
And a U.S. captain's got to protect a ship.
Sure.
So when you've had the coal incident, so you know.
And I'm not trying to say they're good guys. Don't get me wrong.
All,
you know.
So there's enough going on in that kind of an incident that, you know, those ships could mm-hmm. easily have been blown out of the water, and the incident could have gotten blown up to proportions. You also got in history a tendency for little issues. I mean, when you look at the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand that set off World War One, it was a fluke by itself. I mean,
right.
Archduke Ferdinand, his car basically got lost, and they took the wrong route, and they were going retracing the route, and they went down the street, and they went by the guy who, you know, ended up shooting him. I mean, the whole thing was kind of a comedy of errors.
Then you got to wonder about Providence, too, and some of those things, too.
Well, and that set off World War One is ridiculous because, you know, the Austria-Hungary at the time and what Serbia was and Archduke Ferdinand and all of that, even in the structure of Europe, was pretty much of a detail. I mean, it was important at the time, obviously. Just as the Tonkin Gulf incident got blown out all out of proportion, it was probably fabricated to begin with. The same here in this incident. But to answer your larger question, when the government is moving in a certain direction and presenting information, I think skepticism is appropriate because, you know, I'll even go this far. When any of these major incidents occur, the Twin Towers come down.
Mm-hmm.
We have a tendency to appoint these commissions that come in and whitewash the situation with a political answer. The 9/11 Commission was one of the most political commissions that we ever set up. But so was the Kennedy, you know, the Warren Commission, looking at the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
I mean, that committee didn't even know that Lee Harvey Oswald had connections to the CIA and the FBI. And when they began to find out about it, they suppressed the information to present him as a lone nut. And this theory that Arlen Specter came up with the, you know, the
ricocheting bullet, the
magic bullet theory, is, you know, patently absurd because there was not enough lead out of that bullet to explain the lead that was found in Connolly and in Kennedy from supposedly that bullet. The bullet was virtually pristine.
Right. So just a conservation of mass. There's not enough mass to count for everything.
Well, I mean, you just take a look at the bullet fragments that were removed from... This was the one bullet that was supposed to have gone through Kennedy's back, through his neck, through Connolly's wrist, you know, into his thigh, through Connolly's back, into his wrist, into his thigh. And anybody who knows anything about weapons at all knows a bullet that did that much damage, there wouldn't be any bullet left.
That's right. Be fractured, that's right.
It would look like, you know, it would look like a little blob by the time it was done, and pieces of it would be everywhere. And there was enough lead taken out of Connolly and should have been taken out of Kennedy that was supposed to have come from that one bullet, and yet the bullet's pristine. Well, that's ridiculous. So I would, if it were my decision, if I were in charge of these things, I'd appoint a commission that would have on it the skeptics.
Right.
In other words, I'd get the Alex Joneses and the others of in the scientific community that doubted this happened. I put them on the panel.
To give some legitimacy to it.
And I'd say answer their questions to their satisfaction. Otherwise, I'm not accepting your result.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now if they probed and asked questions and kept going, I'd say, fine, keep it going. Because, look, if they take 10 years to do it, and they investigate everything and they raise all these issues, those issues are going to be raised anyway.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You're not going to suppress those issues. And it's like science. People forget that science does not progress by establishing anything. It progresses by refuting ideas and hypotheses that are no longer valid because new evidence doesn't it's not consistent with that hypothesis.
Right.
So you reject the hypothesis and look for a new one. When you find a new one, it doesn't mean you prove the hypothesis. It means you've got a better hypothesis now that supports the evidence you've got. You could get new evidence, and it could demand a new hypothesis.
Well, we have, even in our scientists, have lost that respect for the scientific method. I'm a scientist by background myself, my career field. And, you know, I was taught that in grade school, the scientific method.
Right.
And it's routinely broken in major area, whether we talk about our origins or whether we talk about all sorts of things.
I hear Al Gore talking about established science has proven that the global warming is caused by human beings. Okay, now, at that moment, I'm switching the channel because I'm saying, first of all, there is no established science. It doesn't exist. Science is all provisional. It's all based on what we know so far and the best explanation we can come up with.
And it's progressive.
It's progressive. It's meant to be. Look, you start out with Copernicus. Anybody who's read Thomas Kuhn on the on the, you know, the theory of scientific revolutions knows that this is the way science is meant to progress. So Copernicus says we're at the center of everything. Well, you know, that's a great idea until Galileo comes around. Okay, so we're not at the center of everything. Well, let's face it, we're not at the center of anything. We're, you know, off in some distant spiral of the Milky Way galaxy. And we don't even know where the Milky Way is.
And a good scientist maintains a skepticism even of their own answers in the current status quo, perpetually.
Perpetually, and operates with provisional, this is as good as we can do today.
Right. And mathematicians have done a pretty good job of keeping that. Mathematicians always know whatever they've modeled so far is only just that, a model.
Right.
And that as they progress, they'll learn more. And I think they've done a good job in their field of saying this is just how close we've approximated the truth.
Maybe better than most. But
maybe.
You know, the idea, okay, here you go into chemistry. You take chemistry when you're a kid, and you're first of all taught there's organic and inorganic chemistry. Well, this is nonsense to begin with. All chemicals are inorganic. Just because something, you know, and there was a scientist, I forget his name, in the 1850s, I think Lorenz or something, a German scientist, a chemist that synthesized urethra, you know, urea,
right,
which is the primary constituent of urine.
Right.
He made it synthetically in a laboratory. Well, and this is supposed to be, something that came from a living being. Well, he made it clear that, no, it's just the chemicals being put together in the right formulation. Yeah. And so, you know, hydrocarbons are supposed to be living because oil comes from living tissue and hydrocarbons are deteriorated, bio-tissue. Well, it's all nonsense. There is no difference between organic and inorganic chemistry, except that organic chemistry is the field that looks mostly at hydrocarbon structures.
That's right, carbon-based form. Well, let me just make a little quick comment you might be interested in here, and then I want to ask you something before our last break. You mentioned this whole thing about global warming. I had an interesting involvement in that, and I have to be a little careful what I say here to not step on toes. My work has been in the field of research in organic chemistry related to chemicals that are not supposed to deplete the ozone hole or create global warming.
Right.
In fact, I received a Stratospheric Ozone Protection Award from the US EPA.
Well, congratulations.
So at least I have a little bit of credibility in that circle there by osmosis at least. But I worked alongside the government scientists for the official government agencies that were tasked to come up with the models for global warming and
right,
these atmospheric effects. And while I did not assist them in that particular task, our work was co-funded. I was right there along the path while they were developing their models and while they were presenting their data as it progressed. And my understanding from being there and personally eyewitnessing the stages of what they were doing was that they readily admitted, amongst their peers behind closed doors, that their models were extremely crude. And they were very complicated models with a whole lot of different coefficients and parameters, of which only a couple of them they had the very simplest of data. The rest of it were, for lack of a better term, fudge factors or educated guesses that were put in. The only problem is that they maybe made up 95% of the model. The goal was to hopefully replace some of those over time and make it better. And I can't speak with absolute authority since I'm not an atmospheric scientist, though I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. But no, I actually worked alongside them. But I watched the progression of their understanding, and the models are so sensitive to slight changes in one or two parameters in the guess that you can get answers all over the map.
Well, it's why the climate, you know, change models, which are, you know, even more difficult than econometrics models to predict the economy, there's no way any of these models are any good at all.
Well, and I'm not trying to criticize these scientists. They're very intelligent people. Don't want to
but we don't have the data.
Well, and I will say, too, and this was a fact even the field I worked in, if you found results that were counter to the political winds, you could count on your funding stopping.
Well, and also, the models can't predict anything that come true. And none of them, they always just, when the models don't work, they change the models and fix the data, so it looks like it came true. But none of them, a model that can't make predictions is worthless. The scientist who synthesized urethra was Frederick Wohler in 1828. He was a German chemist. He synthetically created urea. And, you know, I mean, we can talk about that afterwards. And we can talk about how, I believe in abiotic oil. I don't think oil has anything to do with oil is not dinosaur soup, and it's not.
Well, we need to dedicate a show to that because that's another big topic. It would be very worthwhile for our listeners.
We could have you on here for about 10 hours.
To talk about, when we have our 24-hour telethon.
Yeah, there you go.
All Dr. Corsi all the time. I got one other topic, one of these other teensy tiny topics I want to ask you before our break.
Okay.
And that's a real simple term, and that's what's going on Wall Street. I'm sure you can explain it all clear to us in probably one sentence or less. But we see some interesting shenanigans, and I don't know how much you get involved in this aspect of it or not, but obviously we've seen in the last week, we've seen unprecedented activities from the Federal Reserve and from our own Treasury Department. I know one case that I noticed, and I'm paraphrasing the exact terms here, but they doled out something on the order of $200 billion to a number of banks, and of which one of them, I believe Bank of America, turned around the same day and gave that $200 billion to Countrywide Financial to bail them out. And then we see this somehow closed-door thing going on this weekend where we have J.P. Morgan being brought in and salvaging Bear Stearns before it creates a juggernaut cataclysm in the financial field, which our financial people in our own government are, to me, are really, really stretching the bounds on what they're authorized to do. I know they think they're maybe doing things for our best wishes. I'm thinking they're mostly protecting their own cronies. But things are going on that are unprecedented in this area, too. But to me, I've got to think they're somehow related to the theme of what you've been looking at with this strategic partnership. Do you have any comments on this and what's really going on? Have you heard anything behind the scenes?
Well, I write a lot about it. I spent 25 years in financial services. I created broker-dealers and worked with banks around the world.
I guess that makes you relatively
qualified.
Yeah, maybe even more than me.
You know, so I argued in Lake Great USA that the currency was going to be, wrote a whole chapter, the currency was going to be made to be near worthless, otherwise we'd never give up the dollar and move into the Amero, like the euro. And so I think that I've argued going back to 2005 that this whole crisis is engineered because we kept artificially low interest rates. Greenspan had them at 1% in 2003 and 2004, and that was certainly calculated to cause the real estate bubble that we've experienced. And now they're working to bail everything out. But this is the worst financial crisis that we've gone through, Greenspan since World War II, I think since the 20s and 30s.
Oh, yeah. Maybe even worse.
And it will surely cause a major recession. And the solution will be offered is, look, we'll have to go into a regional economy and a new currency in order to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be engineered to be that deep a financial crisis.
And that's where it dovetails into the North American Union.
Yeah,
so a new currency with a new entity.
I argued that solidly, and I predicted this 2 years ago in the Lake Great USA. I predicted the bank failures, the currency failure, that this would be the unfolding of people were living in their houses and saying, my house has doubled in value. I said, no, it hasn't. Your house hasn't doubled in value. There's a manipulation of the real estate market going on, so it may appear to have doubled in value. Your house will also quickly be worth half of what you think it's worth.
So if you're an independent investor out there, aren't you really just on a roller coaster ride out of your own control?
Well, you are, but there are ways to kind of predict which way the roller coaster is going to go next. But, you know, it takes a great deal of experience. Just like we're saying, I start out by, like I start out with looking at government explanations as saying, I don't believe any of this. I start out with the economic data and looking at what I'm being told about markets as I don't believe any of this either.
Mm-hmm.
I basically spend all day long working and writing and watching CNBC with the sound off.
Yeah.
I don't want to see what they're saying. And what they're saying is just cheerleading the market. I look at the data, and I'm watching the data on the tickers and watching it move through the day and seeing what they're covering.
Yeah.
But I'm also on the computer watching all the data on the Wall Street Journal online, which has got great databases.
You don't rely on Maria Bartiromo for your
No, I barely know who she is.
I rely on Kramer myself.
Yeah. His track record recently has been
wonderful.
His advice
was pretty good about staying in Bear Stearns.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to comment on that last, what was it, Monday, Tuesday?
Yeah, he said it was a great idea
great,
to stay.
Great. It's a great buy.
Great
I don't know why
buy.
Anybody's getting out.
Yeah, he's better than any politician in putting spin, because I called nobody tonight.
I just want to see him get sued over that. You know,
right,
he's giving investment advice over the...
He'll find a way out of it, though. I've never seen a guy like him to exploit and manipulate other people.
He must cover himself in petroleum when he goes into the offices.
What do we expect to see in the near future in that area? Do you have any kind of predictions based on what you know?
Oh, sure. I mean, the stock market gained 420 points today. I don't expect that to be anything except a little bit of euphoria. If the Federal Fund rates is 2.25%, how much lower can Bernanke take it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, every 20 minutes, Wall Street's asking for another rate cut. Okay, so just put the rates at zero.
They're addicted to the crack.
Just put them at zero. Yeah. Put the rates at zero. It can't go any lower.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll pay you to take credit. I'll pay you if you borrow from me. You can't do that. Okay, so he's getting... Bernanke's almost out of ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
He's got very few bullets left. He's put 60 to 70% of all the Treasury securities the Fed owns up for borrowing against at these discount windows and other facilities he's created. He's worse than Helicopter Ben.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's printing money faster than it's ever been printed. And just, you know, if you're a bank or whatever, he's just, how much do you want?
Yeah, actually, our co-host here, Tom, was talking about the 0 point to me earlier tonight.
Yeah, we may be
where we get to
approaching
the point
that.
Where they you can offer them all the credit in the world and people just aren't
nobody
willing to take
it
anymore. And then
they had interest rates at about zero in Japan.
It didn't help them. Mm-hmm. Didn't help them at all.
All people did was use the yen as a carry trade. They,
right.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, well, they're about ready to start using the dollar as the carry trade currency.
Well, at least somebody will be using a dollar.
Yeah.
Well, what about those people who are trying to flee the safety and putting their money in treasury bonds or even in the inflation?
Anything you've got in dollars is going to be devalued because the value of the dollar is going to go down.
Even if you have inflation-indexed treasury bonds?
They're lying about inflation. They've got inflation down to...
Yeah.
Core inflation.
The CPI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the CPI is all manipulated. They've redefined it.
Right.
So core inflation takes out oil and food, the two major impacts that have made inflation jump.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, your inflation adjusted, a lot of things are supposed to be inflation adjusted. Your Social Security payments are supposed to be inflation adjusted, but when they lie about the CPI, you're not going to get a bigger Social Security check.
Right. So what do you do?
Well, you know, gold's a good investment. Swiss francs is a good investment. Stay out of dollar-denominated investments, no matter what they are, because they're all going to devalue.
Mm-hmm.
If you can buy real estate with cash, buy real estate with cash, especially if you can get it, you know, at bargain prices, because at least you're holding land is only they're not making any more land.
Right.
That's been the statement.
What about income generating real estate? Is that a good idea?
Can be. You know, it's more of a headache.
Well, I wouldn't even think about rental income. I was just thinking about, you know, some business place, laundromats or things like that where people, you know.
Can be. All those can be.
Yeah.
You know, there's in every economic downturn, there's always opportunities to make money.
Yeah.
But you've got to have cash and you've got to do it in a smart way. And cash dollar investments are not good.
Mm-hmm.
Anything where you can get a hold of a real asset that's tangible, that you can use that asset, that's probably a good idea.
So sound as a dollar doesn't mean anything anymore.
Dollars not sound.
No.
Well, we need to take our last break.
Okay.
And it's a good breakdown because our next song is dedicated to the God of this age and the God of our materialism. I think you'll recognize
this
song.
You're going to play Money by the...
Well, you're close. You listen to the words of this song. Yeah. We're going to actually play about the guy who's behind all this.
Okay.
And talking about the what's going to happen to our money system and our whole materialism-based situation and what's going to happen ultimately to it. So I think you'll enjoy this as well as our ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Corsi, we'll come back and we'll wrap this up with our last segment here.
Good.
Thank you so much for all your great information.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, hang on and we'll be back with our last segment of Future Quick.
I am the God of Hellfire and I bring you fire.
This is Dr. Future back with the Future Quake Show with Tom and our guest, Dr. Corsi. Dr. Corsi?
Yep.
This is probably the same old music you hear all the time when you're on the
air. Yep. Very,
you're right.
Very run-of-the-mill, very run-of-the-mill. Yep.
I just love that message that gets lost in that song. You know, you fought and saved and earned and all of it's going to burn.
Right.
A lot of people miss that in the theatrics. Well, I appreciate theatrics.
Yeah.
We had a little scrum here while we were off air.
Right.
And Tom has an excellent question he wants to ask you.
Sure.
And then I want to ask you one that's so off the wall that you may
off the wall.
You may just hang up and never talk to us ever again. So
yeah.
I'll risk it, but I want him to ask the legitimate question first.
Well, we were talking during the break. Why is it that, you know, you talk a lot about how George W. and John Kerry and a lot of these other people have sort of succumb to this Hegelian dialectic. You've went through the same classes, been to the same meetings. How come none of that stuck to you?
He may be skull and bones for all
we
know. So you didn't go to Yale. You're a Harvard man. I'm sorry.
No,
yeah.
I listened to all this stuff, and I never believed any of it. I mean, it was always... The first time I read Hegel on bureaucracies and world governments.
Oh, he's nutty.
And Hegel was the one who really set the basis for the United Nations. I mean, I had to say, did he really write this stuff? I mean, this is so ridiculous.
Yeah.
I had to read it two or three times to believe that he really wrote it. I just didn't kind of make up something this dumb reading it.
Well, isn't one of his central premises is that there's no truth?
Well, Hegel believed that there was pure reason. He believed that there was a dialectic that would evolve us toward pure reason. And then when we achieve pure reason, we would be at the ability to see the kind of structures and forms that were behind all thinking and behind all material objects and behind all history. We go beyond history. The idea beyond history originated with Hegelian thought.
Sounds like the stuff people would say at Grateful Dead concerts.
Well, it's not that dissimilar. You have to read things like the Critique of Pure Reason. I mean, I read a lot of Hegel. I read a ton of Hegel. And I thought it was all nonsense.
You know, what I took from Tom's question when he was suggesting it to me off air was that, you know, here you could have been one of those guys up
front.
Yeah,
but you weren't. You aren't.
You had your ticket punched. You had all of the right credentials.
Yeah, but I was always rooted in, I've had a lot of experience even growing up, you know, I guess I was born with it, kind of a real politics experience. I mean, I even as I was a child, I never believed anything even that my father told me. My father was a very tough guy. He was a labor union guy. We used to sit up at night and watch Johnny Carson or Jack Parr late, and he would drink, and we would laugh and talk about the politics. See, I understood politics at a very early age. I was born in 1946. I distinctly remember watching the 1952 conventions on television.
I guess you heard great political speakers and commentators on Johnny Carson, like Floyd R. Turbo, right? You remember his editorial comments?
Yeah.
You know.
Hey, I go back farther than that. I go back to Dave Garraway on the Today Show and J. Fred Monk. You know,
yeah,
J. Fred
monkey. That monkey.
It says chimpanzee.
Chimpanzee, excuse me.
Chimpanzee. And I kept thinking as a kid that any day I could watch the show and Dave Garraway was going to blow his brains out on the air.
But actually,
I think he did commit suicide at one point. Well, I kept thinking as a child, this guy is suicidal. He's going to kill himself.
Well, Muggs actually would be preferred today over most of the people we've
talking
about.
They had the original. They had the original Jack Lasculli. Do you remember Jack Lasculli, the original weatherman that they had on the original Today Show?
Now, you got me on that one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember all these guys.
Yeah. Well, can I ask you a really, really bizarre question?
Right.
It's so bizarre, I was trying to think of something nobody else ever asked
you. He was a little bit nervous to ask this, to be honest.
Just go ahead.
By the way, we've gotten through about half our list. If I could just tell you a little bit of what I'd hope to talk to you about tonight. This is something way out of left field. I kept, in trying to keep up with the news and all sorts of various sources, I kept banging across a sort of bizarre story. And it related to some strange meetings going on at the United Nations with a large number of delegates from different countries that involved this rash of UFO sightings that are ongoing. And some people that had been at these meetings and saying that our government and military had been showing all sorts of new data regarding that and saying that there was going to be some kind of announcements over the next few years or anything. Have you heard anything at all about that?
No, I've heard these things from time to time. And
well, I've seen a rash just in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I've seen more, too. First of all, going back to the Roswell incident, you know, there's pretty good indications that there's been suppressed data and the, you know, for decades on UFOs and other encounters. Bill Burns, if you know Bill Burns, who co-authored books with George Norrie.
Okay.
And you see Bill Burns. Bill Burns shows up in the UFO specials and shows on the History Channel. Bill is one of their top commentators. I know Bill very well. Bill was responsible. He was the agent that got me to do a pop-up book on Leonardo da Vinci.
Da Vinci?
Yeah, I did. I did a pop-up book on Leonardo da Vinci in the 90s.
I'm sorry I didn't mention that in the introduction.
Yeah, you just have to search it on Amazon. In fact, I buy them occasionally when I, you know, just just to have a few. I got one delivered in the mail today from Amazon.com. One of my pop-up books on Leonardo da Vinci.
Inflating the price of your pop-up books, are you?
I try to buy them cheap. I try to buy them cheap, but I see them on Amazon cheap.
Would that help any sales of your current books if you did a pop-up version of
Great
USA?
Of North American
there you
Union.
Go.
Yeah.
Might be a good idea.
Too scary, probably.
Look, Bill Burns, and I've known Bill Burns a long time, and he's been into this, and I've questioned him in detail about it. And there's lots of unexplained things, okay? There's lots of things that need better explanation. I've read all this stuff since I was a kid. I mean, Van Doniken and the Chariots of the Gods,
right.
I devoured
mm-hmm.
all of that. Valakovsky and the Worlds in Collision in
yeah.
the 50s. I devoured every one of those books I could get my hands on. Okay, mostly I thought they were all nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Edwards, Stranger Than Truth, or what did he used to write? He used to write Strange World and Strange This and Strange That. He had lots of little stories.
You know, evangelicals are getting involved in this and trying to look at that in terms of an end times paradigm, you know, with Genesis 6 and the Nephilim and all
okay.
that.
Okay, the idea that we're the only species of intelligent beings. I mean, first of all, the idea that we're intelligent beings takes a lot of
yeah. We've debunked that tonight, I think, if we've accomplished anything. Yeah.
That we're the only species in the universe, whatever the universe means, that, you know, our intelligent beings is largely untrue. We've talked tonight about that scientific paradigms are, you know, largely only put forward as provisional truths. Well, anybody who has studied any of the scientific structures. I mean, I take a look at Tesla. I've been fascinated with Tesla since I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tesla, most people know Tesla's experiments with, Tesla's responsible for alternating currency.
Right. Yeah.
Edison had direct currency. Tesla said, that's nonsense. Here's alternating currency. Tesla was also responsible for Marconi's. He helped Marconi understand that sound and everything can be propagated through waves over the air. Well, Tesla also...
He could send energy.
He wanted to send electricity over. He wanted to propagate electricity without wires. Tesla also did a lot of work on what he called the ether and anti-gravity. Tesla was very strong into anti-gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And the Nazis did a lot of work on anti-gravity. And the Nazis were very deeply into Tesla and his anti-gravity science. They were trying to produce anti-gravity flying machines.
All right. Those little discs that they've seen pictures of,
Yes, and there's, you see the, Bill Burns was on this with the Roswell stuff. There's, gyroscopes and other equipment that with Nazi insignias on it that were anti-gravity equipment.
Mm-hmm.
I've read all that stuff, and I'm fascinated by that stuff. I'm convinced that we don't understand time or space in any fundamental way. I've been convinced of this since I was a child. I'm reading Einstein. Okay, Einstein wrote a lot of very good books. I mean, I've got some of them right here. I mean, Einstein, one of the best books that Einstein ever wrote, called Out of My Later Years. I've got it right here. And he wrote a book also called The Evolution of Physics. Got three or four of his books here that I've read since I was a kid. Now, Einstein maintained, of course, with theory of relativity, that time is just another dimension, and that time is not all just going forward like we perceive it.
Mm-hmm.
And Einstein got into contemplating n-dimensional spaces which have different time coordinates that are, coordinate with ours but different. So like alternative universes you could enter into and go out of.
Right.
Well, these things have always fascinated me because, scientists get into dark holes, which when I was a kid they didn't even know existed, and various kinds of understandings of what they have now observed going on in the universe with better telescopes and with the Hubble telescope and the like. You got to come back to the fundamental principle that we know very little, and that our science is actually very primitive. And if you start from there, rather than starting by saying we know everything and that we're very smart, look at how accomplished we are, we have, color TV and flat screen and high definition, You know, well, that's great. Why do we need a screen?
Right.
You know, I mean, project that image onto the wall. Tesla would think about things like that. And to me, I think if we look ahead to the next generation, whatever it is, of scientists that come along, as long as they don't get tied into the... That's why I've always liked science, and I've always thought scientifically about politics. Politics tries to get you tied into a definition of what's going on, the same way that Al Gore says established science for global warming. There is no established science. And there is probably politics, there's the fundamental politics, the truth of politics, mm-hmm. is Aristotle's, and that is that there is always politics. It's always in contention. It's always at stake. It'll never be gotten rid of. And it's always in doubt and always fought over.
Well, you know, I could see it. We're coming up here to the end of our show, but obviously you are a living indication of the quality of education that was available to us in our earlier generation. We're lucky these days to have people that have any kind of expertise in one area, much less what you're able to demonstrate in a number of areas.
Well, see, when I was a kid, when my dad went to college, he went like the GI Bill, and I used to read all of his college books as a kid. He'd come home at night, he'd be mad at me because I'd be reading his college book. And I'd say, they really teach this stuff in school? I'm reading his geology book, and they're talking. At that time, they believed that only geological change was incremental, took long, gradualism.
Right.
I said, Dad, this is nonsense. I mean, we drew along the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and you look at the different segments, different sediments of rock, and, you know, there's pretty solid orange there for a while, but then it turns into light brown. What happened to the line where it changed? That doesn't look very gradual to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I basically said, okay, I'm not taking any science. John O'Neill, my co-author in Unfit for Command, accused me when I wrote Black Gold Stranglehold of having extended my high school chemistry too far. I said, John, I never took high school chemistry. I refused. So that's what they're teaching. I'm not taking it. And I did that across the board in so many different subjects that by the time I was get through a lot of school, I spent time just showing up at classes and saying to professors, you know, you got two choices. I could attend this class or you could just give me an A.
And you're still debunking people today. You know, I bet you people don't ask you much about these kind of science things, do they?
No, but I enjoy it when they do. I love to do it. George Norrie told me someday I ought to write a book on Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be fun to do.
Well, I want to tell you, we're coming to a close right now. We're going to have to run. But, Dr. Corsi, you are welcome here anytime.
Well, great having you on.
I know you're incredibly in demand, but I really would like to have you back. Please, everyone, check him out at worldnetdaily.com, his articles. Get his books, and they're listed there, as well as The Late Great USA. You can get just about anywhere, Amazon or wherever. Black Gold Stranglehold and Atomic Iran, a bunch of other ones. But, Dr. Corsi, can we have you back sooner rather than later? I want to ask you about Admiral Fallon, what's going on there.
I'll be happy to. You guys won't believe it, but not tonight, okay? It's 11 o'clock here in the East Coast. And I'm in New Jersey. I'm going to have to – I drive to New York City tonight, and I'm on with Joey Reynolds starting at 2 a.m. WOR. I'll go on with Joey Reynolds from 2 to 3 a.m. tonight.
Well, it's fine that you can go on with people when after you hit the big shows like ours. If you have time left over after the big ticket stuff like us, feel, you know, coast to coast or whatever, a lot of times they'll get our cast offs.
Coast to coast. I like to be on with George Norrie regularly. I really enjoy that show.
Well, I hope you feel the same way about us.
I enjoy you guys. I'll be happy to come back.
Please do, Dr. Corsi. Great. God bless you. Have a great day. Thank you for all your work on behalf of all of us.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Take care.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I hate to run, but our time is up.
Gosh.
Did you enjoy it?
Out of all the guests we have on here, I think I learned the most when we talked to him.
And we just scratched the surface. We're not able to get the depths of...
I just got a little bit of Corsi under my fingernail, and that's about it, you know?
Yeah. You're not going to wash that Corsi out of your hair, are you?
No.
Okay.